for the Pacifica Radio Network, the Public Radio Exchange, Global Community Radio, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schuck, and that's the last time I'm giving that introduction. Progressive Spirit is ending. It's the end of an era, and the reason is numerical. I realized the other day, counting on my fingers, 2012, 2013, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, that I have completed 7 years of radio shows with Progressive Spirit, formerly Religion for Life. 7 years, seven complete seasons. Seven is the number of completion. So obviously, it's a sign. It's a wrap. My last interview is today with Fred Provenza, Nourishment. The show's ending. But I am keeping my once per month show, The Beloved Community, on KBOO in Portland, Oregon, from 9 to 10 a.m. every second Friday. But the weekly podcast here and radio show, Progressive Spirit, is finishing now after 7 years. I started the show thanks to encouragement by Teresa Keller of WEHC in Emory, Virginia. She wanted a progressive religious voice to counter all the fundamentalist religious voices so prevalent in Appalachia. Emory was a bit of a drive, though, and so I needed a station a little closer to home. I approached Wayne Winkler of WETS in Johnson City about the idea of an educational program about religion. Wayne was warm to this idea. He taught me how to produce the show, encouraged me all along the way. The show has survived the death of my son, a move to Portland, a format change from a half hour to an hour long program. And in addition to WETS and WEHC, the show airs on about 15 to 20 community radio stations on a weekly basis and is available to others through the Pacifica Radio Network and Global Community Radio. The show is going to remain online and available for anyone to access for free. The show has always been free, of course, with no advertising, no subscriptions, no donations to keep it going. It was supported by my two congregations, First Presbyterian Church in Elizabethton, Tennessee, and Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. But the show takes time, preparation, production, promotion, and my interests are changing. I am interested in issues of war and peace, truth and goodness that mainstream media and including much of alternative media are not allowed to address. I'm talking about the big ticket items, the global, so-called global war on terror and all of the false flags, lies, and Islamophobia that fuel it. We're not talking about it. Progressive Spirit isn't really big enough for that. Ending the show is my decision. I never like to keep things beyond their expiration date, and Progressive Spirit has expired. So what's next? I don't know. Of course, I have my own personal studio. I have my monthly show, as I said, on KBOO. I'm producing with a friend, Josh Townsley, a documentary film for the love of Hussein. It's in the production stages right now in regards to my trip recently to Iraq. I'll have more time to write my own ideas. ProgressiveSpirit.net is still the website. That may change, but right now you can get everything there. But for the time being, I need to focus on my congregation and its needs. This trip to Iraq and the connections that I have made are very exciting. This is an interfaith and intercultural opportunity beyond my wildest dreams. But I need to spend time with my local congregation here at Southminster and see if this is something that we're both going to do. But whatever happens, it's all good. It's been good. Stay with me. I'll be writing and posting stuff at progressivespirit.net. You'll find out if that address changes. Facebook. There's more to come, as they say, inshallah. And now my final show. The book is called Nourishment, What Animals Can Teach Us About Rediscovering Our Nutritional Wisdom. My guest is Professor Fred Provenza. He's a professor emeritus at Utah State University. He directed an award-winning research group and has authored over 250 publications in scientific journals and books. He's a sought-after speaker. His pioneering research hinges on the idea that a healthy body knows what to do with wholesome foods. Appreciating this simple insight could change dietary recommendations from an endless stream of latest advice on what and what not to eat to creating cultures that know how to grow and combine wholesome foods into meals that nourish and satiate. From Ennis, Montana, welcome, Fred Provenza, to Progressive Spirit.
Thank you, John. Wonderful to be here with you today, that's for sure.
Now, you started your book nearly 20 years ago, 1999, the year you were diagnosed with cancer. And so this book really is a long time coming. Can you talk about the journey of writing this book and the scope of it?
Yeah, as you mentioned, I wrote the first draft back in the late 90s, was diagnosed with cancer, and then had a 10-year program develop out of the cancer and everything that happened during that period. My colleagues and I decided that we really should try to get the word out on the research that we'd been doing for the last 25 years, and that developed into a program that we termed BEHAVE. And that just swallowed up the next 10 years. And so I put the book in the back burners and didn't start on it again until about 2009, when my wife and I moved to the backwoods of Colorado.
And then you took from 2009 to the present to finish it.
Yes, yes. And let me give you just a little bit of background on how I see the book and the setting where the book was written. For me, nourishment is about the mysteries and wonders of a visit to Earth. It's quite reflective in that sense. I wrote the book after I retired while my wife Sue and I were living in the peace and tranquility of the backwoods of Colorado. We were 12 miles in on graveled road into the backwoods, far back as we could go. And in a word, I think it was a meditation. We were living at 9,500 feet elevation in the transition zone between the conifers and aspens and this beautiful expansive parklands of what's called South Park. We were surrounded by 14,000 foot mountain ranges. To the south, the Sangre de Cristo Range. To the east, the Sawatch Range. To the north, the Mosquito Range. And to the east, the Terrials. We were really immersed in the beauty of nature, of the natural world, from the exquisite arrays of grasses, forbs, shrubs, and trees that live in those environments, to the marvelous insects, birds, small and large mammals that make up the backwoods and make the backwoods their home seasonally, if not year-round. So it was a wonderful time and place to reflect on the mysteries of, as I say in the book, of a universe in the process of consuming itself, from galaxies and stars in the cosmos to herbivores, omnivores, and carnivores above and below ground on the Earth here. You think about it, we live in a universe with some 200 to 300 million galaxies, each with billions of stars. At the center of each of these galaxies is a black hole that's in the process of actually consuming the galaxy. We live on a planet where life lives by consuming itself below and above ground. And so in the book, what I do is use comparative food selection, nutrition, and health of plants and animals, from insects to human beings, as a way then to reflect on the mysteries and wonders of existence. In a sense, it was in awe and with humility that I wrote Nourishment as a way to give thanks for my moment on Earth, with all its horrors, beauties, wonders, and deep mysteries.
Yeah, because your book really, it goes in many different directions, many philosophical aspects to it, and I want to get to that as we get going. But in 2001, you mentioned earlier that you directed this research group, Behavioral Education for Human, Animal, Vegetation, and Ecosystem Management, BEHAVE, and the website is behave.net. And according to the website, my sentence description is, they seek to inspire and enable people to understand behavior, ours and other creatures, from genes to landscapes. So can you talk about kind of the work of that group, and how that book connects, how your book connects to that group?
BEHAVE started back in about 2000. We wrote a proposal to basically to try to do outreach. We'd been doing research for 25 years. studying not what animals eat and where they go, but trying to understand why do they do that? Why do they eat the foods they eat? Why do they go the places they go? And that accent on why is what makes the work of BEHAVE more universal. If we'd simply looked at what animals eat, where they go, it could be interesting, but it's not going to be able to say, well, that relates exactly to what a human being does. When you look at the whys, then it really starts to tie in with the human part. So my colleagues and I that I'd worked closely with throughout the 25 years up until that point, we'd talked over and over again. We all came from ranch backgrounds of one sort or another. So we had this practical application side to us. And we talked time and again about the implications of what we were doing for managing animals, for reducing costs of operating ranches and so forth. But we'd been so involved in doing the research and publishing the findings in scientific journals that we hadn't really done much outreach, reaching out to people on the ground. When I was diagnosed with cancer in 1999, we all realized that could be the end of the program if I'd have not lived, just due to the nature of the fact that I was the key investigator, you know, the person that was running the program. We knew that would have been the end of it. So we thought, you know, we really need to try to engage other people across landscapes. And that's how BEHAVE came about. We received a large grant to do outreach, and that included everything from fact sheets, DVDs, all just tremendous amount of booklets, outreach that we did on the program over that next 10 years. We met on an annual basis, and we started with a quote advisory board of 45 of the most innovative people we could find around this country. And the innovators were people doing stuff on the ground, managing landscapes in one way or another, whether it was ranches or farms or federally administered lands like the Forest Service and BLM. We pulled together the most innovative people we could to interact with us. That group grew to over 250 people. Our annual advisory board meeting to over 250 people by the end of the program. And it was really, to me, a fabulous opportunity to have really innovative scientists in the room with very innovative managers, and looking at the creativity that was flowing between those two groups, the way they nurtured one another. And we had so much really nice on the ground research going during that 10-year period with those folks on the ground, and they were using the research that we developed over the last 25 years to put into practice. It was just it was a marvelous experience. I often think back and wish I was about 40 years younger, because it's the kind of program I think that's so needed nowadays. And I was reading a really good paper titled Saving Science a couple of years back. And the author was arguing that science for science's sake nowadays is really taking us nowhere. And it wasn't meant to tear science down. And I'm not saying what I'm saying now as a way to try to tear science down. I think it's such a valuable tool. But science can wander off in its own world. And I think science that's grounded in real live people doing real live work on landscapes becomes incredibly powerful and incredibly co-creative with people on those landscapes.
If you're just joining us on Progressive Spirit, my guest is Fred Provenza. He's the author of Nourishment, What Animals Can Teach Us About Rediscovering Our Nutritional Wisdom. Just speaking there about the research group that you founded called BEHAVE, can you talk about a couple of conclusions, the big things that this research work led you to think about, and how that comes across in your book, Nourishment?
I think from the standpoint of understanding how processes work related to food selection, nutrition, and health, there are three things that are that really came across in a powerful way that relate to everything from insects to human beings and the domestic and wild animals that we studied. From a practical standpoint, so many different things came out of the program as a result of working with people on the ground and just really low-cost ways to manage landscapes. And the understanding and the application just absolutely meld together. From the standpoint of food and habitat selection, nutrition, health, I think the thing that probably the overarching thing that we contributed during our program is this whole idea that animals are learning, that learning is fundamental to food selection, nutrition, to co-creating or co-evolving in environments. I think it's fair to say that up until the time that we did our work, people appreciated, at least for wild animals, the importance of their ability to survive in environments, their amazing kind of abilities. And I think there was a general feeling at that time that they know how to do it. We don't know how they know. It's in their genes. And you can often see explanations that really make things seem more like it's genetically driven. Environments or animals and populations propose and environments dispose. But our work over and over and over and over again showed how terribly important learning is in figuring out what and what not to eat, where and where not to go, what's a predator, what's not a predator. All of these kind of things are, animals are learning these things. If one realizes, at least as the paleontologists tell us, that the average lifetime of a species is, 10 million years or so, you think of the tremendous amount of change that takes place on this planet during those vast time periods, even during the last 10 to 20,000 years, tremendous, tremendous changes. And yet we know that species have this incredibly stable genome. It can change, but not rapidly, and it's known for its stability. So the question is then, well, how does this incredibly stable genome co-evolve with these incredibly dynamic landscapes? And learning and this whole field that's referred to as epigenetics are really two such important facets of understanding that. Epigenetics is simply the ability of the genome to have genes turned on and off, and they're turned on and off as a function of their interaction with the social environment and the physical environment, and that begins literally in the womb at conception throughout that the period in the womb, and then early in life interactions with mother and peers. Many of the animals we studied end up living in extended families of matrilines. And so there's tremendous amount of learning that's taking place. And I think a key to this, too, to understanding, so genes are being turned on and off. What does that mean? From the standpoint of food selection, what we were able to show is that experiences early in utero and early in life change how organ systems in the body develop. From the gut to the liver to the kidneys to the central nervous system, those things are plastic, and they're really being influenced by the experiences that an animal has. And so this whole field of learning and epigenetics, I think, is that's the big thing that we really contributed, in my mind, over the years, is to show over and over again how animals are learning, and the subtle and nuanced ways and ways that we historically had never, no one had thought about.
Well, I have a question for you about goats. You started your book about goats. And as we talked before the program, I grew up near where you live now, and I grew up in Whitehall, Montana, and we had a little farm. My father is still living. He's 100 years old. He taught at chemistry at Montana Tech, and he had this little farm. And we had a noxious weed problem in the 80s. Maybe it's still a problem, called leafy spurge. And so we're trying to keep this leafy spurge spread down. And so my dad bought a goat. I guess he read somewhere that maybe goats would help, that the goat could eat the leafy spurge. So we bring this goat home. We pick some leafy spurge and we give it to the goat. He eats it, he throws it up, and he never eats it again. And so then Billy now becomes a pet and an annoying part of the family. He eats all kinds of stuff, but he doesn't eat the leafy spurge, never again. So I often wondered whether Billy objected to the leafy spurge or to the way it was presented to him. Any insights?
It could be both things, John. It could be both things. And your example with Billy raises a really interesting area that we spent a lot of time studying early on in the program. And the way I refer to it in the book is flavor feedback relationships. Let's explore that here for a minute. If you think why any individual eats a food, I like to ask people that question, where does the food go? And it's interesting to see it. It stumps people a little bit, and it would have me years ago for certain. You'll get inquisitive looks, they'll say, well, to the stomach, and yeah, that's true. But ultimately, where food goes is to cells and organ systems. If you think what's being fed, it's the trillion cells that make up our body, including the microbiome that everyone is quite interested in from the human standpoint nowadays. But it's these cells and organ systems. And what we were studying is what I refer to as feedback. And it's the realization, and it floored us when we started doing this kind of work, that it's feedback from cells and organ systems that changes liking for the flavor of food as a function of need. And for all of us humans, our experience of eating is of liking foods or not liking foods. But we don't realize that at this non-conscious level, feedback is actually changing our liking for the flavor of food. And that's what we were able to show with goats like Billy. You know, we were working with a plant in southern Utah, this would be 45 years ago now, called Blackbrush. And we were using goats during the wintertime as mobile pruning machines to prune the shrub during the winter. And then if there was decent moisture in the spring, that stimulates new growth on the plant. And we knew from laboratory analyses that the new growth was much higher in energy and protein and minerals than the old woody growth on the plant, which is the reason we were using the goats to prune the plant. We wanted to improve those rangelands for cattle that ranchers wintered on those landscapes, as well as for mule deer, bighorn sheep, and other wildlife species that live down there. So far, so good. But what really was the most amazing part of the whole program was that the goats didn't want to eat the current season's twigs. It was absolutely clear from the very beginning of the work, once we'd already built 2 miles of fence in the scorching sun down there in St. George, Utah, from the very first that we saw goats have the opportunity to eat current season's twigs on plants, it was clear that they didn't want to eat that. So the question is, you know, what's going on? And I remember talking to a toxicologist / nutritionist, a good friend of mine, a very senior faculty member at that time, who didn't believe, by the way, that animals possessed nutritional wisdom. And I told him about what I was seeing with the goats. And he said, well, I guess that just goes to prove that goats and other domestic animals don't have nutritional wisdom, doesn't it? Well, I didn't know what to say at the time, but I didn't believe it. I knew there had to be more going on than what met the eye. And what we were able to show as we continued to study this issue was that the new twigs in blackbrush have very high concentrations of compounds called condensed tannins that actually protect that new growth from being utilized by creatures like goats. It's a protection a defense of the plants against being overly utilized. And if the goats eat much of that, makes them sick, like Billy, which we learned. And so they learn very, very quickly. In fact, within a meal or two, they figure out, just like Billy did, that this stuff isn't good for you, and they avoid it. So this whole idea then of flavor feedback relationships and cells and organ systems, including the microbiome, changing liking as a function of need, is something we studied for 30 some years. We were able to show that feedback is so important for energy, protein, minerals, vitamins. This whole host of what I refer to as secondary compounds, these broad classes of alkaloids, terpenes, phenolic compounds, on and on and on. It's the interrelationship amongst all those compounds at a cellular level that leads to the feedback. And that's being mediated, without going into too much detail, by neurotransmitters, peptides, hormones. There's whole suites of nerves. There's an anatomy and a physiology that underlies all of this. But the bottom line is that it's changing liking for flavors of foods as a function of need. And that becomes one of three legs to a stool that make up nutritional wisdom of creatures, whether it's a goat or a human being. And we can explore the other two legs if you'd like as we go along here. But that first leg is really related to Billy and these flavor feedback relationships.
Yeah, well, let's go ahead and talk and connect to the human part. But I will also, just one question in the middle, I guess, is domestic animals. I mean, there's a whole, pets, dogs and stuff, a huge industry on dog food and nutrition. What about that in regards to what dogs have this nutritional wisdom, I guess, but yet at the same time, somehow that's been overridden by, would you say, the dog food industry?
Well, without overstepping my bounds by a long ways here in terms of the industries and so forth, one of the things that strikes me that we've done, and with the rations that we formulate, whether that would be for dogs, as you say, or when domestic animals are placed in confinement in feedlots, or and that could be anything from chickens to beef cattle, you name it. The disciplines of nutrition have figured out, through many, many studies, basically the needs of animals. What are the needs? And I give nutrition tremendous credit here. So what I'm going to say is not meant to be a critique of that. I mean, tremendous amount has been learned. But what that boils down to in the examples that I'm using here is that they'll formulate a ration that's for the average individual. And I think that does two things that fly in the face of nutritional wisdom. The first, and I can't overstate this strongly enough, is there is no average individual. We know for human beings that every one of us is unique to the point where we can be identified by our fingerprints. A bloodhound can track us by our odors. If we were to look inside of our bodies, we would see tremendous, tremendous differences in how each of our organs is built and in how they function. There was a man named Roger Williams who wrote a book probably 50, 60 years ago now, the first edition, titled Biochemical Individuality. And he was talking about human beings, and it's the most comprehensive book I've ever read on how different each of us are. And we showed that over and over again in our research. So no two individuals are alike. So when you formulate a ration for the, quote, average individual, it is good for the average individual. The problem is there is no such thing. And we showed that time and again in the studies we did, where we would formulate a ration for the average individual. and feed that to groups of animals, and then allow animals to self-select from the ingredients that made up that ration. And on average, they came to the same place, but when animals were given a choice, they selected completely differently, each unique to themselves. And it actually cost less in food when we allowed animals to self-select because they ate less food. So that's one issue, is that there's just no average individual that exists. The second is that needs change by individual from day to day, week to week, and so forth. And so that ability to be able to self-select from a variety of different choices enables not only nutrition, but if those choices contain a variety of species, plant species, that have this vast array of what I referred to earlier as secondary compounds, or I often like to just say simply phytochemicals, these compounds that plants produce by the hundreds to tens of thousands. It's amazing. Those become pharmacies, not nutrition centers and pharmacies. When you start to really look at what people are learning from a science standpoint about the benefits of those for cardiovascular disease, for cancer, for metabolic syndrome. It's overwhelmingly interesting and important to realize that.
So what I'm gathering here is that goats and animals all have this nutritional wisdom, and which comes back, I suppose, in the terms of taste or sickness, on how foods are selected, and they're selected based on really what their biological cellular needs. So, and human beings are animals, so we have that too, and yet at the same time we have obesity problems, and we don't seem to be eating well. So here's the heart of the book, I think, right? What have humans lost in terms of understanding their nutritional wisdom?
So I mentioned earlier that there are three legs to this stool. And the first is the flavor feedback relationships that are a fundamental part of how animals are built and how they function. The second part, and the second and third legs to the stool get really right at your question and your point. The second is the availability of alternatives. And when there's a wide array of wholesome alternatives available on landscapes for wild and domestic animals, those landscapes become nutrition centers and pharmacies. The more we restrict the availability of alternatives, and that can happen even on pasture. Say you have just a monoculture of one plant species. There's not a lot of ability to self-select to meet needs, or in a feedlot where you have a total mixed ration. That same idea applies with human beings. The availability of alternatives has really changed during the last 100 years for human beings. The foods that we grow, the potentially wholesome foods, fruits, vegetables, and meats, have gotten blander over that time period. The nutritional quality of fruits and vegetables has declined over the last 50 years, as several very nice review papers point out. The same is true for meat. The flavor of meat has gotten much blander, and that's a function of what we feed animals on finishing rations in feedlots. The phytochemical complexity of the foods they eat is not great, and so the biochemical complexity of the meat is not great either. So the way that we grow foods, the varieties we've selected for, the ways that we pick and process, pick foods, fruits green and ship them, all those things diminish the quality of the foods for human consumption. No way to overstate that. And again, I'm not trying to be the big critic or anything, just reflecting on what I have come to understand reading the scientific literature, and then from my own palate. Several years ago, going back to Billy, we were working with fruit producers in the Northwest. We had learned what you saw with Billy, that you can train animals to avoid eating particular foods if you change feedback relationships. But the point I want to make here is we were up there with some fruit producers, and they were talking to us about the way that fruit has changed over the years. The size of trees, the flavor of fruits, the varieties, and so forth. And at one point, I'll never forget, one of them said, you know, now, so this is what we ship to the markets for you to eat, but I'm going to take you back to the corner of this orchard because this is what we eat. And the difference in flavor was night and day. The old varieties had this tremendous, tremendous flavor compared to the new varieties. Here in Montana, as you probably remember, John, in the late summer and fall of the year, when you go for a hike in the mountains, it's not hard to pick 10 different berries, 10 berries from 10 different species, service berry, choke cherry, buffalo berry, on and on and on. What strikes you about the flavors of those fruits is that they have a lot of punch to them. They aren't just sweet. And I'm not a flavor describer type of guy, or I would be able to give you all these elaborate kind of terms that they use. But there's a richness and a punch and a pungence and to those fruits that we've lost, I think. And so that's one issue then, is the potentially wholesome foods that we grow have diminished in terms of their phytochemical and biochemical richness, which means health benefits for us. On the other hand, we've developed this tremendous, tremendous number of processed foods that really, from a nutritional standpoint, are pretty similar when you get right down to it. What we do is we change the flavors of those foods. We figure a tremendous amount of way to artificially flavor those foods to enhance our liking for not so nutritious kinds of foods. These processed foods are high in energy, no question about that. And so you get this tremendous immediate positive feedback from blast of energy linked with flavors, with artificial flavors. And so that's a kind of a 1-2 punch. We've diminished the flavors and phytochemical and biochemical richness of real foods, and we've made processed foods all the more desirable. And that trade-off is huge in terms of where things have gone in the last 50 years in terms of obesity, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and so forth. That all ties back to that second leg of the stool, which is the availability of alternative, wholesome foods.
Fred Provenza, my guest on Progressive Spirit, if you're just joining us, his book is called Nourishment, What Animals Can Teach Us About Rediscovering Our Nutritional Wisdom. So we've really created fake foods, I mean, that are really disconnected with what our bodies have evolved to process and to consume and to let out for the universe. We've really kind of disconnected ourselves from our environments.
We have, and I think that's a perfect way to say that. We've ended up disconnecting ourselves from the environments that we inhabit. And, you know, two things that come to my mind in the book. One, there's a chapter, How to Poison a Rat, Cow, or a Human Being, and it's really about what we're talking about, these immediate kind of positive feedbacks, delayed, really negative kind of health consequences to the whole thing. That becomes really, really a critical thing. The other part on the disconnection, what is it? In the United States, I think only less than 2% of the population actually farms or ranches nowadays. Most folks live in the cities. But as I point out in the book, there are really, I think, tremendous opportunities for us to reconnect, even if we live in cities. For instance, where Sue and I live now, and we made this a deliberate choice, we have just a small piece of ground, only an acre and a half, But we thought about what we wanted to do with this acre and a half. And we thought, you know, we'd like to leave most of it in the native plants and to encourage the native plants that grow here. And I think that's one disconnect that's happened. I worked for many years on a ranch in Colorado. I went to school in wildlife biology. I loved the outdoors. I loved wild plants, wild animals. And I came very much to, over those years, to just have a deep kind of love and appreciation for the beauty of the different plants, whether they were grasses, which seemed to be kind of demure and maybe not so showy, but when you start to learn to identify them and you realize how beautiful they all are, to these forbs or flowering plants that come and go, to the shrubs. Well, all that's here in our yard, and seasonally, from the early spring when the bright little phloxes are showing up to the summer when all these other kinds of species that I won't take the time to name are showing up, to the fall. You just have this beautiful display that's ongoing that, by the way, provides lots of habitat for insects, including bees and so forth. So we thought that. Then we thought, you know, the other thing we love to do is grow our own vegetable gardens, herbal gardens, grow all of our own herbs, and then medicinal gardens. And so we can reconnect, and in the process, we can cut back on the amount of resources. And this, again, it's not being preachy. I'm not trying to even suggest that people should do this or whatever, but you know, we use tremendous amount of resource out here in the arid West on irrigating lawns and golf courses. The fossil fuels we use to mow those lawns, and the amount of gas that spilled doing that. The amount of pesticides that we use spraying everything that doesn't fit into a monoculture lawn. All those are ways that we've come to look at landscapes, and all those are really resource intensive kind of ways that I think continue to disconnect us. And again, I'm not meaning to be try to even come close.
Oh, go ahead and preach it. I mean, it is, we are poisoning ourselves, and we don't even know better. Fred Provenza, my guest, Nourishment, What Animals Can Teach Us About Rediscovering Our Nutritional Wisdom. You talked about three legs to this stool, the first being the flavor feedback loop, the second one being the diversity of available food. What's the third leg on this stool?
The third one is the social cultural part of things, the learning that occurs transgenerationally in utero and early in life, and the extended families that animals live in, that we used to live in. Actually, we lived more in extended families back in the days, and the support of that just becomes tremendously powerful in terms of the other leg to the stool. We know, for instance, starting in the womb, that the flavors of the foods that mother's eating are getting into the amniotic fluid. So a young offspring is learning before it's even born what's food as a result of what mother's eating. And as I mentioned earlier, those experiences are changing the development of organ systems within the body. If we have time and you want to go into that a little bit more, I can give some examples. But it's not just that it's changing liking and getting a young animal familiar with what's food. It's changing the development of organ systems so that animal is better able to utilize those foods after it's born. Once an animal is born, flavors in mother's milk are, again, cues to the diet that mother's eating. And we showed all this time and again in studies with domestic animals, but there's a rich, wonderful literature in human beings that's showing that same thing. As young animal starts to forage, mother as a model, you know, what mother eats, what she avoids, all those are so important cues that help an animal to become locally adapted to a landscape. Then animals learn where not to go in the landscape, where to go seasonally to obtain certain foods and so forth. As I mentioned earlier, they learn what's a predator, what's not a predator. There's just, to me, it's marvelous how that works. And there's no way to overstate how important that is for the health and well-being of animals and for their linkages to landscapes.
We have about 10 minutes left, so I want to talk about the kind of the bigger picture that you have in your book of the spirituality of it. But before I even get there, just kind of a practicality on helping humans rediscover their nutritional wisdom, because it's rather confusing. We can't really trust just what tastes good now, right? Because of all of these chemicals and kind of the well, explain that a little bit. How can we begin to trust, I'll put it that way, our nutritional wisdom?
I think the key is in what I'll say is figuring out wholesome foods. So fruits and vegetables, meat that's sourced from places where where it's coming from. I think really trying to think about what is wholesome foods, which means avoiding the processed foods to a great extent. My wife and I don't just totally avoid eating anything that's processed. It's just very much in moderation. But having an accent on figuring out where you can either grow your own or get your own wholesome kinds of vegetables and fruits and milk and cheese and meat, I think that's the key. The reason we can't trust our palates anymore comes down to the processed foods and the fact that they have hijacked the system. They figured out how to really hijack the system, and so that can't be trusted. But it's figuring out where you can get really good quality kinds of foods, and then just getting yourself weaned off of the processed foods, which can be a challenge, but there's many examples of people that do it and ways to do that. And then from there, just letting your body guide you. You know, there's nothing more needs to be said, I don't think, once a person gets on to eating really wholesome foods.
And of course, that's a real challenge in a time of great inequity, when sometimes processed foods are the only thing affordable for so many people.
But yes, and there's a short and a long term to that, John, as I know you know really well. The short term, the cost can appear to be less, but the long term, the cost is so much greater. So that becomes a whole topic in and of itself, though, ways to find wholesome foods. There was a book written by Joe Robinson a few years ago, Eating on the Wild Side. And I think Joe did a great job of trying to talk about when you go into the grocery store, what are some ways to start looking at all that produce and thinking about which is going to be most phytochemically rich for you. I've just written a paper that this is for a scientific journal, but it's really talking about that from the standpoint of meat and meat quality and the linkages from soil through plant diversity, through the quality of meat and dairy, and then to human and environmental health, including climate change. And I'm happy to share that with folks. It'll be published here in the not too distant future. And I think we'll also have some versions of that paper that are more for the popular press as we go too, but it takes some work nowadays. It really does. You can trust the wisdom of your body once you figure out in your area what's wholesome foods and how to source those.
Fred Provenza, my guest. He's the author of Nourishment, What Animals Can Teach Us About Rediscovering Our Nutritional Wisdom. You're listening to Progressive Spirit. Your book starts there. It goes a lot of places. And one of those places is like the bigger picture, and as well as the individual picture of what life is about. And there are so many questions to ask to get you there, but I don't know where, but I'm going to pick this one. You went through and you wrote in your book a period of depression, 5 years, really a vulnerable reflection that you wrote here on your part. Maybe that's a connection to this larger question. I want to get to know Fred Provenza. Do you mind sharing what that period of depression taught you?
Not at all, John. And I think, just to preface the comments that I'll make, to me, these become very, very individualistic kinds of experiences that we have, and very individualistic in terms of our reflection. So again, not meant in any preachy way or anything like that, but just that last section of the book, Dining on Earth, A Visitor's Reflections, is really that, just thinking back over the what I think of as a visit to this beautiful, beautiful planet. And I think it was on that part I wrote that I'd become a cosmic voyager with amnesia. I'd kind of forgotten why I came to the planet. But those 5 years of depression, up until that point, I had been such a happy-go-lucky fellow. And it really caught me by surprise, this whole depression business. I was all of a sudden just so down and out. Like I said, I had to look up to see a worm. I really didn't understand how it had all happened. And it seemed like it would never end, actually. The 5 years seemed like, you know, it would just never end. It was a chore just to get up each day and do what needed to be done. I had a wife and two children, and so you just had to get up and keep going. But that was transformative for me. And I think of that, and then the cancer that came 10 years later. I guess I'm a slow learner. And then 10 years later, another event. But I really look at those now as transformative periods that really, I see the trials as transformative. And I understand in the world's beautiful mythologies of one sort or another, why people talk about trials as transformative. I started during that time period to read about world mythologies. I had a friend, actually a very cynical friend, who was an editor at the Ag Experiment Station at Utah State University, who gave me this book. He said, "You're a sick so-and-so." I won't say what he said. And I said, "Yeah, you're right. You know, when you're down and out." He said, "Why don't you read this?" Well, it was the text from the Joseph Campbell, Bill Moyers documentary, The Power of Myth. And so I was reading that. My wife and I were reading that to one another and just talking about world mythologies and how beautiful all the different world mythologies were. I started then reading in quantum and relativistic physics. I had taken physics in high school and college and actually never really liked it very much as a subject, but it was more classical physics, Newtonian physics, so to speak. Nothing against Newton there, but when I started reading about quantum and relativistic physics and where those physicists had gone, it's like, oh my goodness, this is amazing, amazing. And I could see how it related to world mythologies. And so I just read and read and read and thought and thought and thought about all those things during that 5 year period. Eventually the haze cleared and I came out of that. I never taught a class the same way after that. I never thought of anything the same way after that. I could have never written this book had I not had that experience. It just changed. To me, the details of the subject matter, including what's in Nourishment, became simply the vehicle to talk about the mystery, the wonder, the amazing, just the miracle of the whole deal.
Yeah, you talk about that even having cancer as a gift. That's a big thing to think about, I think, in terms of the events that we have and all the thoughts we put out of them and all the despair we receive about all of these kinds of things. And how does that change us to look at events as gifts? For example, you said, "I often wondered how the people we despise come into our lives to teach us to love."
Yeah. That brings tears to my eyes always, that thing. You know, when I had cancer, I didn't dread it either. And I didn't say, why me? Why me? That just never occurred to me. It was scary. It really shook me for sure. And I had some powerful experiences after I had surgery laying in. It was this time of year, actually. It was this time of year. And I remember laying in the hospital and the Christmas lights and the peace and tranquility of that. It was and this incredible peace. I tried in the book to just give a little bit. This incredible peace just came over me that, you know, that there is just absolutely nothing ever to worry about during this business. It was so powerful. And but I remember during that time period of life too, just always in my mind was teach me to love, teach me to love, teach me to love. That was constantly, you know, learning to love and having that love, try to manifest that love in everything you do, your interactions with people. It guided how I taught courses, and it took me a long time to get there in terms of how I taught courses, but the last few years of my career were just, they were powerful experiences in the classroom. They really were. We laughed, we cried. They were rigorous courses, but they were about dialogue and about having a group of 50, 60, 70 people all involved in really deeply meaningful kind of conversations about life and about managing natural resources, which was the title of this one course. But they were at this bigger level, this bigger philosophical level, right on down through to what we did. But the, you know, what you, how you have to manage those, but so much about people and our relationships with one another and how profoundly important that is in terms of co-creating with the landscapes we inhabit.
We're going to have to leave it there. Love to talk with you a lot more. Fred Provenza has been my guest. His book that came out at the end of November 2018 is Nourishment: What Animals Can Teach Us About Rediscovering Our Nutritional Wisdom. And as you've heard from Dr. Provenza, it's a whole lot more. Dr. Provenza, thank you for this book and for your lifetime work and for sharing that with all of us.
John, thank you very much for all that you're doing as well. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you here today.
You've been listening to Progressive Spirit, and you heard the last episode. I've now completed 7 years. Thanks to all of the radio stations who have carried this show. In particular, thanks to WETS and WEHC, who really started the whole thing and believed in the whole deal. All of those podcasts will be available as long as I can afford to keep them online at progressivespirit.net. More to come. I'm John Shuck. Be well.